If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56david.com. Lower.com, equal housing lender, MLS 112-4061.
Well, hi, everybody, and welcome to Paul Listnick Behind the Curtain. It's our appearance here on WGN Plus every weekend, which you can watch at 10:30 a.m. and 4:30 p.m. following Mike Toomey's great Laugh Tracks show from our morning show team. And it also airs Sunday at 4. Today, we're going to be talking to, well, I'm going to call him an author because he's written books, but he's much more than that. Comedy writer, legend. They made a whole movie about him. Bruce Valanche joins me with his latest book called It Seemed Like a Bad Idea at the Time. Bruce, you are a legend. We've met many times through the years.
And it all started in Chicago. What can I tell you?
Well, yes. And for people, by the way, I have to explain this. I never appear on TV or anything like that in a T-shirt.
That's
but
right.
You do. And I decided.
Not nothing but.
And I decided today, this is in tribute to you. Chicagoans understand this is Cuddly Dudley, who's a TV legend from the Bozo days.
Bozo, I remember. I was on, I think it was on Bozo. But.
Yeah, and well, Cuddly Dudley was another morning show at that at back in the 60s and whatever. So here's a shirt in tribute to you. That's why I'm doing it. Plus, you're kind of cuddly, aren't you?
Yes, I am extremely cuddly.
I'm actually just noticing with your hair.
I'm the centerfold of Cuddly Monthly.
Plus, your hair, it's not.
Those who still read magazines.
You're a little cuddly like the dog here. Anyway. Let me ask, you always do wear a T-shirt. Is there a tradition or purpose behind that, or it's just comfortable?
It just kind of happened. I was living in Chicago in 1970, writing for the Chicago Today, which folded into the Trib. And
nothing to do with you,
I was a hippie, and we wore a lot of T-shirts because it was a political act, because they all had slogans on them, except for the ones that just had, like, crazy Paisley stuff on them. So, and when I moved to L.A., I realized I could go anywhere in a T-shirt in L.A. You don't have to dress for anything. So it's almost like Hawaii, except you have to wear shoes.
Right.
Hawaii, you can go barefoot any place. But and it just kind of became a trademark, and it was the 70s, and people were wearing them, and I just never grew out of them. It became my brand.
Exactly. Enough that it led me to do something I haven't. I haven't done this in 35 years of television, worn a T-shirt.
I think I'm floored. It's a tribute.
Well,
and especially like high shrieking yellow is really good.
I went through everything until I could find the right one. You know, when you were a bit younger, one of the things that I've read about you is that your actual original plan in journalism, whatever, but you wanted to be the next Neil Simon, the incredible playwright who wrote Odd Couple. So I don't know that your direction went in that, you know, in that direction, but talk about Neil Simon, why he was
he was actually the biggest playwright since Shakespeare. He had four or five things running on Broadway simultaneously. There was a new Neil Simon play every year, and things went into movies and television like The Odd Couple. So he was like the big deal, and he was, you know, a nice Jewish boy from New York, and I was a nice Jewish boy from New York, and I loved his sensibility, but what I really loved was his productivity. I mean, he just kept putting out. He was a writer. And then I got to know him when I moved out to L.A. and he was out there, and we hung out in some of the same circles. And I admired him because everything he wrote was so well constructed and full of character. But I realized that was actually not what I was doing. I was writing a different kind of thing. I was writing sketches, and I was writing material for people. And I wasn't as good at construction as he was. So I would have collaborators who were better at that than I was. And it just, you know, and then, of course, that kind of theater sort of drifted away. It actually went into television. Television sitcoms became very much like what Neil Simon was writing for Broadway.
But many of the shows became sitcoms.
That's exactly right. And he but he taught me many valuable lessons. One was never finish anything. Never get up from the writing table or from the computer with a situation that's going to leave you with a blank page or a blank screen. Always have something that you can sit down and attack immediately.
Wow.
And when you finish that, start something right away, because you have to avoid that period where you just don't know what you're doing. That you can do that when you're not trying to, when you're not writing. Stuff will come to you, and then you sit down and you write it. But I found that works. It works every time. It's like I never leave a hot computer.
I only met him once. He was in a restaurant eating with somebody. I could tell he didn't want to be disturbed, but I decided it was about me and not about him. So yeah. I just went up to say hello, to shake his hand, and left him alone. But I needed to be able to say I shook the hand.
He was very private. He was a very private guy.
Yeah. One of the other things I thought was interesting, that near the opening of the book, which I have read cover to cover, called It Seemed Like a Bad Idea at the Time, great name for a book. But you mentioned that all the work you did that you're not, well, that you call bad ideas, this was all before the world of podcasts, and yet the reason this book exists is because of the world of podcasts.
Yeah, absolutely. What did that mean? Well, you know, during COVID, we were on lockdown, and everybody was sitting at home looking at podcasts, basically, and they were hosting them from their homes. So I wound up getting on a bunch of them that a friend of mine was organizing, and they were all hosted by people who were not born when these things I wrote were committed, but they had all seen them. Because we thought, you know, it was the 70s to the early 80s, and we thought, well, if it's a bomb, nobody will know. We bury it, you know. But the graves were not shallow enough, because the minute the internet came on, everything bubbled up onto YouTube, and so all these kids were talking about these shows like the Star Wars Holiday Special, which George Lucas tried to destroy after it was on, and they had all seen it on YouTube, and they all wanted to know the same thing: how did this happen? Who said yes to this? And have they paid their debt to society? Very important.
Well, so, one of the things you said in the book, you said, first of all, one of the reasons a lot of those kind of shows did happen was because cable was beginning to emerge, and they needed to find a way to keep audiences watching regular TV.
Well, that's true. They always were variety television, but it wasn't quite as crazy. After cable came in, they were trying to get things that would divert eyeballs off of HBO and back onto ABC. Of course, they couldn't do the things on ABC that you could do on HBO. HBO represented ultimate freedom. And now when streaming came in, you have Netflix and Hulu, which represent ultra hands-off. You can do anything. So it was very difficult to compete. But in order to kind of keep up with what they thought was the younger, hipper audience, they kept producing these older, squarer shows. That's how the audience looked at them. And you know, I look at them now, and they were so in the category of so bad they're good.
We're going to talk about the chapters in the book specifically. I first want to stay with my Get to Know Bruce thing and other things that aren't really the focus of the book. First of all, as a classic comedy writer, you've written for almost everybody. I mean, let's start with Bob Hope and move it up and down from there. But yeah. One of the things that was really interesting about that, you talked about the egos of these comedy legends, but the one thing I wanted to ask you, and here I am talking to you, what about the egos of the comedy writer? You'd write classic gold for all these people, but they delivered it. They got the people gave Bob Hope the credit.
I also say in the book that most comedy writers are default sour. We suppress the ego because we have a bigger ego to deal with, and that tends to make people kind of bitter and sour, and when they're not sour, they're bitter. Writers are like that a lot because you create something and then everybody else dives onto it and tells you what's wrong with it or how you have to change it to appeal to this one or that one. So, I mean, they're all, it's kind of like, I would take like a mother with a newborn and everybody is telling them how to raise the kid.
But there is a Bruce Valanche sense of humor. I mean, but when you write for Bob Hope or you write for the Oscars, for which you've won Emmys and have been nominated for a million Emmys for that, you have to write for other people's voices, right? They can't sound like Bruce Valanche.
No. If they do, you failed. You have to pay due diligence, and you have to, I mean, there's a style if there's a marriage between your style and their style, I mean, the things that you want to make jokes about, if you have a similar point of view. But if you don't, you have to find out what theirs is and write to it. The comparison I always make is with Bob Mackie, who has to design dresses, and he has for Cher and for Lizzo, and he's not going to put them in the same dress. You know, they're not.
That gave me a visual
A-lock.
I can't get. There's a visual I can't get rid of.
Well, you know, I mean, Lizzo won't look as good in a mermaid cut as Cher will look.
Right.
So, But everybody winds up looking great because he has a sensibility, a design sensibility, and they're there because they want to be glamorized, which is what Bob does. So, but obviously he has different things to work with, and he has to pay attention to who the client is. And it's the same thing with me. Now, if you're Neil Simon, you're creating all these characters out of not thin air. You're creating it out of your own life experiences, basically.
Right.
But that's different. You're the boss.
You spent 4 years at Hollywood Squares. Fabulous. You were also, many people don't know, you were the head writer for Hollywood Squares. So we're going to talk about your Paul Lynde chapter. But initially, I was one as a kid. I would literally, with my little recorder, I would record every Paul Lynde joke each night from the episode. I loved it that much. But I was so disappointed to learn decades later, Paul didn't write those phenomenal answers, even though he looked like he did.
Yeah, I know. He did some of them. He was a writer. He relied heavily on other writers because he didn't think that way. I mean, he was a spontaneous writer. If you said something to him, he would come up with, say something very clever in return. If he had had one cocktail, two cocktails, and he would tell you, he would give you what ethnic slur he could come up with to you, because he was fundamental. He was the captain of bitter and sour. He was not a happy camper.
Would you put yourself, you were Edna in Hairspray. This is my way of just mentioning some things that we're not going to release. That'll be your next book, to talk about the other side of the things you were glad you did. But Edna in Hairspray, the star of that, a talk show where your mom was the sidekick?
Yes, it was. She always wanted to be on television. So I thought, well, why not? I mean, otherwise I'd have some other, old guy, which is what the model was. I didn't know what they would pair me with. They'd already have to have a sidekick. So I thought she'd be fun. Unfortunately, it didn't work out because as vivacious as she was in person, she wasn't a pro. And when there were lights on her, all she was thinking about was, how do I look? And, she wasn't... she froze, basically. And we had, because we were shooting this pilot, we had to kind of coax her out of it. And eventually she kind of warmed up a little bit. But that's because I had the guest stars, Debbie Reynolds and Tim Curry and David Hyde Pierce, who are three fabulous people, and they loved her. So they were trying to help her.
Which would have been a jealousy thing if it wasn't your mom, but I can understand that.
Yeah.
By the way, what is it in you and in people like Ronnie Graham? You worked with Ronnie Graham and know him, and I still remember him from his song Suckin' Eggs. I can't remember what show he did that on.
I forget. It could be New Faces.
But what is it about a writer? Just briefly, I want to get to the book. What is it about a writer that says, I can also be out front on the stage versus writers who go, no, I'm just writing those lines for SNL?
Well, so many of them, so many of the comedy writers came from acting first. I was a child actor, and then I was an actor after that. And I was always performance first. So that was my first thought whenever I would write for anybody, was this had to be performed, and how would I do it if I were performing it? And I think that was true of Mel Brooks and Woody Allen. They started as performers and wound up writing afterwards. And a lot of other people are like that. But then people who are like Neil Simon, who are just writers, have a different process. It doesn't occur to them to perform the stuff.
And there's things that you've done, writing the lyrics for Bette Midler's on the second to the last Johnny Carson show, with her song. I mean, there's so many things you've done that are legendary, and people need to know you did it. You wrote it. And of course, realize working with people like Bette Midler, Whoopi Goldberg, unbelievable. That's the Bruce that people need to learn about. But in this book, we learn about the part of Bruce that you wish people would forget about. Not really. But
Well, I've surrendered. I know they haven't. Now I get trapped. You know, the thing about the internet is my ass is covered with bite marks from things that came back to me.
I love it.
After I thought they were gone forever.
Well, we're going to take a quick commercial break. But when we come back, we're going to talk about these projects that you thought were a bad idea at the time turned out to be comedy gold. And we'll do that with Bruce Forlanch in just a minute. Stay with us.
Thanks.
And welcome back to Paul Lynde Behind the Curtain, talking with the legendary, I can say that, Bruce Forlanch, whose newest book is called It Seemed Like a Bad Idea at the Time. If you don't know as much as you should about Bruce Forlanch, go see the movie Get Bruce, because that'll tell you a lot of what we're not talking about today. Bruce, many chapters in this book, they're actually not written in chronological order. So are they written in the order that they were bad?
No, they're written in the order that they were infamous. The first two, Star Wars is the first one, and Brady Bunch, the Brady Bunch Riot Hour is the second, because those have never gone away. There have been 9 Star Wars movies, well, even more if you count the ones that aren't actual Star Wars, you know, Rebel One and Solo.
Right. But,
Disney Plus has now got is a Star Wars channel, I mean, with all kinds of stuff on it. And the Brady Bunch keeps coming back. I was on a show called A Very Brady Renovation, which is for a house and garden.
ACT, I watched it.
They bought the house that the Brady Bunch filmed exterior out in the valley, and they came in and renovated to look like the actual Brady Bunch set at Paramount. And I did a bit with Barry Williams. I came back on and did a bit we did on the Variety Hour.
Yes.
It's never gone away.
Right.
So I figured they recognize those things. So I upfronted the book. I front loaded the book because Halloween comes every year and it's a show people watch because nobody gets slashed. You know, the only Halloween thing where nobody winds up being put into a blender. So it's a good thing.
Actually, Paul Lynn shows up as number 2 in the book, which works for me. Brady Bunch number 3. But here's the thing, just very briefly, in the Star Wars piece, is it true one of the ways you got Bea Arthur to appear was because you let her return to her diva moment in terms of singing?
She was Maude at the time. It was pre Golden Girls. And she wanted to sing because she was a Broadway baby. She had won a Tony for Mame for playing Vera Charles. And she was the original Yenta in Fiddler on the Roof. And she wanted to sing a song she had sung off-Broadway in the Three Penny Opera, which was a huge hit in New York in the 50s. And it was the first big Bertolt Brecht, Kurt Vile musical to come over. And it was a very serious song. It was the Alabama song, which is, "Oh, show me the way to the next whiskey bar. I tell you I will die." Very up number. And the Bertolt Brecht estate would not allow her to do it. They said 9, which was, I thought, was that the number they wanted for it? No, 9. Just no, nicht, not doing it. And that really was the only reason she did it. She wanted to sing, and she wanted to sing something really torchy. And why she thought that would, the Star Wars holiday special would have a spot for that, I don't know. But somewhere in her mind, she thought so. So, of course, we created one where they stopped. Han Solo and Chewbacca stop on the Tatooine at the cantina. You know that. So there she is serving aliens.
It's gold. It's gold. Yeah, now, Paul Lynde is a favorite of mine, and it is number 2. But you mentioned the Brady Bunch, so I'll go there. That aired in 76, 77, the Brady Bunch hour. Here's what I thought: whose idea was it? Yours? That they wouldn't be Christopher Knight and Mike Lookinland and Robert Reed, Florence Henderson. They weren't going to be who they were. They were actually the Bradys. That's weird.
That was a Chicagoan named Fred Silverman.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Johnny Carson's
who I think worked at WGN.
He did.
And went to Hollywood and at one time ran CBS, then NBC, then ABC, or not in that order. But I was waiting for him to take over PBS because I thought he would do really well there. When he was at ABC or at CBS, he came up with the idea of co-hosts, variety shows. And Sonny and Cher, Tony Orlando and Dawn, those were all his. Right down to the last show ever, the Barbara Mandrell and the Mandrell sisters. So he came up with Donnie and Marie. And he wanted to do a variety show with the Partridge Family, which was the show that shared the hour with the Brady Bunch. The Partridge Family had Shirley Jones and David Cassidy.
Who sang.
Right. And they played a family singing act that lived in a tour bus, pretty much. And they didn't want to do it. They didn't want to do a variety show. So he said, well, maybe the Bradys can do it. And it was an insane idea because the Bradys, I mean, he's an architect. And they're not song and dance people. In fact, we tackled that in the pilot because it was so clear that Robert Reed was not in sync with anybody else. He'd never done this kind of stuff. So, but he pressed ahead with that idea and so it sold, you know, Sid and Marty Krofft produced it. And so we were kind of saddled with the idea of the Bradys. There had to be a Brady story every week. And at the same time, they were hosting a big television show in Hollywood with big name guest stars. And then, so we had them, they moved to a swell house at the beach where they had a swimming pool where they could have a mermaids doing water ballet, which was the equivalent of the ice skaters on the Donnie and Marie show. And it got more and more ridiculous as it went along.
You say big start. You had Tina Turner, Vincent Price, Milton Berle. I mean, the spectrum.
Yeah, Milton Berle, Farrah Fawcett. We had, and it was hard to book the show because it was new and nobody, they all kind of thought it was a little surreal. You know, the first thing is if people tell you they remember the 70s, they weren't there. A lot of this stuff was conceived in a cloud of smoke. And a lot of people were half-baked much of the time.
How did you hide people like Chris Knight will say he could not sing? What did you do with the Bradys that really didn't sing?
They didn't sing, and they held back. The ones who could sing sang out, and of course we had singers dubbing them to give the thing a fuller sound. But he didn't have to sing anything major. I mean, he just had to kind of sing along, so it was okay if he was lip-syncing. Florence and Barry were strong singers.
We all know Robert Reed walked off, didn't appear in the last episode of the Brady Bunch for his, you know, was he easier to work with in the Brady Bunch hour?
Well, he was not happy. He wasn't difficult, but he wasn't happy. He had done the show because he was very invested in the kids because he had been their surrogate father when they were little, because a lot of them came from kind of Mama Rose backgrounds. You know, if you ever watched Dance Moms, a lot of them had dance moms. And he became their surrogate because he wasn't entirely happy with how the parents were dealing with the work side of the kids' lives. So he loved the kids. The kids loved him, and so he came back and did it. And also, I mean, he was not happy with where his career had gone because he was a serious actor. Also, he was a very funny, light comedian, but. He was getting a lot of money, and this kept him at home, which he liked, and he could be around the kids, but he was never comfortable singing and dancing. And I have to say that a lot of them, they didn't really know what the show was going to be. I don't think they thought that they were going to have to show up Monday morning and learn a whole bunch of choreography and vocal parts, and as well as a script of a Brady show. Yeah, the Brady shows are 22 minutes long, and so we had at least 22 minutes of Brady material in the hour, but the rest of it was like variety stuff, sketches, and they were, I used to say to Bob, I said, you don't have to be comfortable in any of this, because you are not Robert Reed, the actor, you are Mike Brady, the architect, who is being, this is kind of like skit night at the frat house, you know, you can play the fact that you're not comfortable in the role, and it will carry you through any of it.
And of course, Florence was probably the most at home for everybody. This was her world.
Florence was absolutely, she was a Broadway star, Vegas star, television star. So she, of course, knew what she was doing all the time.
And by the way,
she would be doing it with this group.
Right.
The kids had an act. The kids had, the Brady kids had an act that played like the Ohio State Fair, things like that. So they had a kind of, you know, rudimentary knowledge of what went on with this stuff. Well, but it was never part of they didn't have to have this skill set to do the sitcom. Of course, they were also older now than they were on the sitcom.
That's right. And some still in it. Bruce
had some life experience.
Bruce, while we are out of time, I just can't be done with you. Do you have a few moments to stay with me after the show is over for a bonus track that will appear on our podcast?
Yeah.
Sure. Then let me thank everybody for watching us here on Paul Listick Behind the Curtain with the great Bruce Valanche, his newest book. It seemed like a bad idea at the time. Pick it up now. It is so good. I've read it cover to cover. And if you're listening to us on the podcast, Behind the Curtain on WGNRadio.com, stay with us. More Bruce Valanche to come. Thanks for watching us here on Behind the Curtain. Have a good week, everybody. And we are back here on Paul Listen Behind the Curtain. This is a little bonus track, as they say on CDs. Do those exist? And we're going to continue our conversation with the great Bruce Valanche, truly a legend in the comedy writing world. I want you to get to know him better. In his new book, it seemed like a bad idea at the time. Bruce, thank you for staying with me. There's so much more to talk about. I want to go back to Paul Lynde. We touched on him on the TV stream, but I wanted to go back to him. I was a huge Paul Lynde fan. First of all, Paul Lynde getting a Halloween special. One of the things you write about Lynde, it's kind of well known he was not a happy man to begin with, but he also wasn't like a stand-up comic. He was always that add-in character to the shows he did.
Yeah, he was a flavor. Paul's whole career was kind of summed up in the big breakout movie Bye Bye Birdie, where he sang, "Kids, what's wrong with these kids today?" And there's a break in the song where he just said, "I get no respect from anybody." And his son says to him, "Oh, Daddy, I respect you." And he says, "Who wants respect from a 10-year-old? That was Paul's character. Nothing was right. Even if it was good, it was bad. And so that was a hard character to build a show around, because your first thought would be, why are they all putting up with him? So he was always a flavor that was interrupt somebody else's life, generally in a negative way. You know, right. The guy who wouldn't give you the loan at the bank.
Bewitched, for example, something like that. But
he was Uncle Arthur on Bewitched, and he was kind of the fly in the ointment all the time.
Yeah. And of course, Hollywood Squares made him a legend, as I said, disappointed to learn he didn't write all his lines, but he delivered them beautifully.
That was perfect, because you could come in and do a joke and go out. And it was, so he had, that was his character. And, but I mean, he made a fortune doing it, because he was in a lot of those Doris Day pictures and things like that. And then Hollywood Squares, of course, made him a big star. And when I met him, he was on Donnie and Marie, because that was he was being paid off for two sitcoms that had not worked. And he had a very big deal as a sidekick on Donnie and Marie. And then he would go do Squares, and I would write things for him on Squares. And then he became a gigantic star. And in the summer, he would go out on tour. He would go out. It would take some other acts with him, and he would kind of be the MC. So he never had to really be the center of attention. If he did, it was for moments. It was very carefully orchestrated.
With Robert Reed, who kind of hid his being gay really until his death, when it became clear he died of AIDS, but he got married, he had a daughter. And Florence Henderson had said that she didn't even know that it was their kissing scenes that made her think something was up. By the Variety Hour, was it also still hidden from the kids and everybody in the show?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, it was still, 1976, something like that. So, I don't know that it was hidden. I don't know that I never actually talked about it with the kids. The truth. I mean, maybe I did with Chris and Barry and Maureen, the older ones. I don't think so. I don't think it was just not spoken about. He didn't speak of it with them, and they didn't talk about it. He talked about it with me, but we became friends, and I was kind of let in on it. But it was kind of an open secret. But it was different with somebody like Paul, who was effeminate, and that was part of his character. It was there would be an eye roll, like with Richard Simmons or Rip Taylor.
Or Liberace.
And Charles Nelson Reilly, any of those guys, because they were playing a certain stereotype. And but Robert was always, playing the handsome young guy.
Right.
And in the case of the Brady, suddenly, was now a father of six.
And people have to remember movies like Making Love, which pretty much cost years off the career of Harry Hamlin, Michael Ancheon, right?
That was a very brave movie at the time, because it was the first, shot out of the canon.
Yeah.
To say, so, we are real people.
When you do interviews on the book, pretty much you've talked about what we have talked about. So I want to go beyond. And I want to talk about some other chapters, such as the, actually, I'm going to go out of order again, Can't Stop the Music. I saw that movie. I went to see it. Alan Carr, known for Grease. I mean, Village People, Nancy Walker directed it. I never knew. That's like Nancy Walker wrote a Nancy Walker, right?
Nancy Walker.
From Rhoda.
Yeah. From Rhoda, yes, right. Yeah, that is the only Nancy Walker. Yeah, exactly.
With that team, why couldn't you get Cher to do it?
Why would you?
Why couldn't you get Cher to do the movie?
She may have read the script.
You wanted her, right? That's why I'm asking. They wanted her.
Yeah, well, I mean, I wrote the first 341 drafts of it before fired and then rehired. But Cher, I think she couldn't see any upside to doing a movie with the Village People. You know, I mean, she still had Sonny at the time. She had, what we used to call, if television is a global village, every global village must have its global village idiot. That was what we called Sonny's character.
In a show with the Village People, by the way, so it made sense.
Yeah, right. So I'm sure she just didn't want to do it. She always had intent to be a serious actress once she got over the rock and roll phase, and of course she did. She did become that, and she would do more, but it's hard to cast her now because, you know, she looks like somebody who was made in the lab. You know, I mean, she can't play the person next door. She has to play somebody who can look like she looks.
Right. Well, I thought it was classic.
Burlesque, which is where she played the woman who ran the Pussycat Dolls and was on stage every night. So that made sense.
And Nancy Walker directing was just, I mean, she was an actress. Now, I think this is the only thing she ever directed, or at least the only movie.
She directed some television shows, and she was Alan's client. Alan was a personal manager.
Oh. Okay.
And she wanted to direct more, and but Alan, I think, had a hard time finding somebody who wanted to direct the movie who would actually listen to him.
I love it. He's the one
the prime mover of the picture. So
his project Grease made him a good.
And she would, because she was his client, and he could talk to her.
And Grease made him gazillionaire, so that's always going to be his claim to fame.
When you have that kind of success, nobody says no.
Right. 1984, The Ice Pirates. How does a movie with box office gold like Angelica Houston end up with 17% on Rotten Tomatoes?
Oh, well, the two didn't happen coincidentally. Rotten Tomatoes was born long after that movie was made. And it was being seen by an audience that never heard of anything like that.
Ah, it was the timing thing. Okay.
Yeah. So, and Angelica, it was her second movie. And she got Pritzi's honor off of it, which is what she won the Oscar for. But I didn't realize it had such a low Rotten Tomatoes rating. I mean, I guess if that's critics, because of course critics didn't like
it. No, I think Rotten Tomatoes is the people.
It, when we opened, it made money. It was a hit. And the thing is, Ted Turner loved it and kept putting it on all of his brand new cable networks. And you couldn't escape it. And now there are generations of people who say, oh, I saw that when I was a kid on television. And Angelica says to me every time she's interviewed by anybody under 40, the first question is, how did the Ice Pirates get made? She says, I can't kill the thing. I can't beat it. I can't beat it with a space herpes. What can I do to get rid of this? She said, I'm a respected person. And they keep bringing up the Ice Pirates.
Well, sometimes you can't escape something. Let's go back to 1978 with Platinum. Here's another thing. If you would have told me that it was going to begin in Buffalo in 77, directed by legendary Tommy Toon, and starring Cheetah Rivera's daughter, Lisa Mordaunte, what happened in 78 when you're involved?
Well, Lisa was a supporting part. It was Alexa Smith, who was a big Warner Brothers movie star and had gone to Broadway and had a huge success in Follies. And so it was kind of developed with, well, it was actually developed with Rita Hayworth in mind, but Rita Hayworth, who was still with us, but really wasn't able to work anymore. And they turned to Lauren Bacall, who didn't want to do it because she had done Applause, which was about an actress facing her age. And she didn't want to do another piece that was about an actress facing her age. And so and Alexis was a big Broadway star. And so that came up. But it started as a small show. It started as what they call a chamber musical. It only had four characters and no dancers or anything. And so for Tommy Toon, it was an experiment because Tommy's a dancer and all of his shows were heavy dance shows. And this was, he wanted to, I think, see if he could work with one that had none of those things in it. It was a challenge. And it was great, you know, for him to work with Alexis. And they started small at this theater in Buffalo, the Arena Stage, which was a theater in the round. And it was about, if this can work, we'll go to Broadway. But Paramount was very interested in it from the beginning. Barry Diller and was very interested in it because of the combination of things. So they began developing, and it got bigger. And that's what Tommy left because it was no longer something that he needed to do. So Joe Layton came in, and he made it, you know, he made it bigger. And the saga begins there. It turns out Alexis was not the box office draw that we thought she was. And which, you know, that meant there wasn't money coming in. And so it's a real Broadway saga. And it's heartbreaking, but it's a good chapter in the book.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's why I want to ask. Is it true that in 1988, the only reason you agreed to do the award show, The Look of the Year, was because you're going to get to go to Japan?
Absolutely. Why else? I mean, I didn't care about a bunch of 16-year-old models. First they were all models, and they were 16. So that was not my kind of bait. But Japan, I'd only been in Japan in a layover at the Tokyo airport. So I thought I'd like to see Japan. So off I went. And it sounded like fun. I mean, I knew it was going to, it was one of those great big stupid award shows. So I knew it was not a great idea. The bad idea, of course, was to try to inflict American culture on Japan, although it has been inflicted on Japan. But we came over with the Pointer Sisters and Louis Anderson and David Copperfield, and all of whom were known. Well, Louis was not known in Japan, but the others were. And a whole bunch of celebrity judges and all of these girls who basically, it wasn't even Miss America. You didn't have to have talent. It was all swimsuit competition, basically, and modeling and stuff like that. And the two cultures meeting in this Japanese seaside resort was what was so hilarious about it. And it turned out the whole thing was financed by the Yakuza, which is the Japanese mob. And they showed up because they weren't happy because they wanted it to be a showcase for the beach resort that they had helped build. So it was funny.
I love it. And I had a great honor once on radio of interviewing Carol Channing and her new husband at that time, Harry, and they were very involved in education. She said, "Paul, can I sing? Carol Channing sing? What will I get, diamonds or what am I going to get?" And she began to sing, "Education is important." And I'm like, can we do Hello, Dolly? But you work so much with Carol Channing. Was she wonderful?
Oh yeah, she was great fun. She was first of all, Carol Channing was a construct. You know, it was a character that she had done, and she would do it a lot. But when you got to know her, she would kind of lay back a little bit of off of all that. She was very bright and very well read, but she didn't like to show that side because she had created this great character, and she only also played two versions of it, Hello Dolly and Lorelei, Jennifer Blonde, where Lorelei was dumb like a fox, and Dolly, of course, was smart like a fox. So those were the two variations on it, and she played that her entire career. And the thing we wrote for in the heyday of the Golden Girls, every old bag in the business was getting a development deal, and so she got a development deal, and we wrote this script for her that everybody loved, but she didn't like, and she never really told me why. She just, I think part of it was, it wasn't her traditional character. She was playing somebody who was a bit more of a human being, and she was closer to Dolly than it was to anything else. But she wasn't a schemer like Dolly. And, it could have been people like that, and she didn't, because she didn't quite know how to play it.
Yeah.
But I'm putting words in her dead mouth, so I don't really know.
Because you are so involved in Hollywood, whatever, I'm going to go off track a little bit with Carol Channing. Many people were surprised. I think she was surprised when she was not cast in the movie version, and they gave it to Barbara Streisand for the reasons that they had. It would sort of be like Lainey Kazan getting the movie role in Funny Girl, I suppose, which Lainey would have loved. But my question for you is, can you talk about what goes on in Hollywood producers' minds when they do something like, we're going to take this legend from Hello Dolly on the stage, we're going to give it to somebody else?
Well, I can't imagine she was surprised because she had no movie career. She did one thing, and she got an Oscar nomination for it.
Thirdly, Molly Millie.
But everything else had been, and that came from the actors who I think were fans of hers, the actors in the branch at the Academy. So but she'd gone to Hollywood after Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, which she wasn't going to get because they tested her and they said she's just too big for the camera, you know. And of course, you know what that is. I mean, you camera, you have to reduces everything. And when you look at Marilyn Monroe, it's doubtful she would have been the stage star because the camera captures so much of her. And she didn't, ever work to project beyond that. But with Carol, she was always playing to the last row in the balcony. So I don't think, I think she was dismayed. And I think when she had two big hits and they both went to other people, both of whom were huge movie stars, you know. So yeah. I think when Dolly went to it, it was only because it was a hugely expensive property and nobody thought that Carol Channing could carry it as a movie because she wasn't a movie star.
And they needed to make money.
Barbara had come off of Funny Girl, which was a big hit, and she won the Oscar. And so she was the next big thing. The fact that Barbara was so young, you began to wonder, well, when did she marry Ephraim? When she was 10? And already she's a widow and she thinks the parade is passing her by? Look at her. She looks fabulous. The hell is she complaining about? But it didn't make a whole lot of sense, although Barbara, who played it very, very much like Mae West, seemed to be her concept.
A Jewish Mae West, yeah.
Yeah. Look, it worked. I don't think it made its money because it was very, very expensive, and there was a whole. They had to hold the release on it for a while, but she's good. She's good in parts of it because she's Barbara Streisand. She's passionate. To watch.
Just one more name you write about in the book, and then I have just a couple of questions outside the book, and I will let you go. I so appreciate this extra time. You write about Charo. I mean, as a kid, I love Charo. I just took to her. Is Charo the Charo we saw on TV? Was that Charo?
Well, very much like Carol. I mean, Charo is the Charo character is a construct that Charo, who's very smart, came up with when she was working for Xavier Cugat, who was her husband, who she said they never had any sex. That was her husband. Carol said, she only had sex with her husband two times. And I said, yes, that's your memoir, Twice Upon a Mattress. but so Charo, she was an extension of that character, but she liked being that character off stage. She's very energetic, but she's also very smart. And she wasn't as bubble-headed as the character that she,
She knew how to play it.
On the Love Boat, you know.
Right.
So, but she's always fun to be around and very inventive and willing to try anything.
I love it. Quick question about comic relief. You worked with Whoopi and Billy and Robin. But in your book, you dedicate, I know you were close with all of them, but you have a special relationship with Whoopi.
Yeah. Yeah, I do. It goes back to before comic relief. When she first came out to Hollywood, actually, but when I met her when Steven Spielberg organized, he had seen the show that Mike Nichols had put together for her on Broadway, and he was eyeing her for The Color Purple, and they organized a special show at the Comedy Store for people to see her, and I went I met her that night. She was brilliant, and I think she got the movie, obviously. But we hit it off. And when she became a star, she had to make a lot of appearances, and she was not used to writing for herself for that. She could write. She had written characters. She always played characters. There was no Whoopi character, but we came up with one, and that would be the thing she would do when hosting something, an award show or something like that. And we did a couple of television things where that worked out. And we've just been close ever since. And she wanted me the host of Hollywood Squares. She wanted me. And they said, they thought, oh, she's nuts, but we don't want to piss her off this early in the game. So let's test him. So that didn't work out. But they put me in the square. My joke is I was on Hollywood Squares just to the left of Whoopi, if that's possible.
Yeah, exactly. I know she, in her autobiography, which I read, I loved it. Actually, I listened to her do the audio. She talked about like her parents or her mom would always call her Karen and stuff. Is she Karen to you or is it Whoopi to you?
I used to call her Mammy. But that was, you know, that
can't do that anymore.
Couldn't say that.
No.
was a joke between us about Hattie McDaniel. We were big Hattie McDaniel fans, and she played Mammy in Gone with the Wind. I generally called her Whoop, I suppose, when I actually talk, but sometimes Karen, you know, Karen is, it always seemed to be like, Karen would be when somebody wanted to make a point, you know, like Karen, you know.
Enough.
So now, when you say Karen, although she doesn't spell it that way, Karen now means something else entirely. You're a Karen, you know, you're just like, you're a privileged white woman who wants.
Right. Yes, it's current word.
You're in my parking space, you know, that kind of.
Finally, Bruce, is there anybody you haven't written for that you wish you had? And I don't mean current people, but is there anybody from the past you went, I wanted to write for that person? Lucy?
No, I wrote for her. I wrote the last thing she ever did, which was with Bob Hope on the Academy Awards.
And okay.
The number together, and then she passed a month later. But she was a guest on several variety shows that I worked on, and I worked with her. I'm sure like people who've been long gone. I mean, I even wrote for Mae West, so I got the tail end of a lot of the golden age. But I mean, there are current people who I think are brilliant. I don't know, they don't need me. John Mulaney doesn't need me, but he's wonderful. And Eddie Izzard is a genius, and I think we now call him Susie. But you know, I always
is it a different world today? But I mean, people like Jerry Seinfeld, are today's comedians, they just write their own stuff now?
Everybody writes their own stuff. Now, I can't speak for Jerry. I mean, I don't know his process. But everybody writes their own stuff until they become famous. And then they are in what Joni Mitchell called the star-making machinery. And they have they're doing a lot of things they wouldn't be doing. And that's taking up the time that they would have spent writing. So that's when they begin to take on collaborators.
Finally, Bruce, you in the book, you say it's hard to get famous and it's hard to get infamous.
Yes.
You both?
Oh, I guess. Yeah, I guess. You know, I have the weird kind of fame where I'll be in an airport doing a selfie for somebody and somebody will walk by and go, who's he? Yeah, why do they all want pictures with him? They don't want pictures with me, but you know, enough to cause a stir on the platform.
Right. I love it. Well, the book is called, It Seemed Like a Bad Idea at the Time. It is such a good read. And it's a way to get to know you. There needs to be, you really do need to, and I'm not kidding when I say there needs to be like, it seemed to be a good idea at the time. There's so much to your career that's brilliant.
I didn't want to write that book. Now I may have to write it.
Okay. It's time. Okay. Bruce Valanche, you're brilliant. You're a legend. Thank you for spending all this time with me. I appreciate it.
Happy Chicago.
You got it.